Perhaps Luke's account of the birth of Jesus is best known because he tells us so many of the outside things that were going on in connection with that birth. It was a time when Caesar Augustus had given the decree that the whole world should be taxed. Quirinius was governor of Syria. He had several of the outside details. John's gospel has none of this. There is no story of Bethlehem, no account of the manger. Simply a going directly to the heart of what happened in the incarnation. As John says, the Word who was with God from the beginning, who was himself deity, became flesh and lived for a while among us. No announcement could be more staggering than that. That for us humans and our salvation, the God of the universe, God the Son, should decide that he would lay aside all of his glory and become a flesh and blood human being, as you and I are, so that we might come to know him better, to understand that he cares for us, is concerned about us, and that we eventually might be with him. He became what we are so that, in a measure, we might one day become what he is. That is, that we might be in his presence, that we might enjoy being with him for eternity. Jehovah in the Old Testament seems so remote from the Israelites, but now Emmanuel is his name, God with us, because he has chosen to lay aside omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence, and become one human being. It's that not scorning our immersion in material things, not looking down on our lack of spirituality, but that free decision to leave heaven and become what we are that makes the incarnation such a wonderful event. No wonder John said that this event, that this one, was full of grace and truth. Grace connotes joy. It indicates an undeserved gift being received. Truth, one of John's favorite words, 25 times it's used in his gospel. Because here is ultimate truth, the truth of what life is about, of how the universe came into being. He comes full of grace and truth. Why would God do that? Why would the God of the universe decide that he would scale himself down to the size of a human being and come and live out a flesh and blood existence in the world? I've said that it's for us humans and for our salvation. But it seems to me we have to understand it in terms of his desire for relationship with us, for commonality. Your relationships with other people are largely based on commonality. If you share things, share experiences, a relationship has a better chance of building. If you're suffering something tragic, the person who means most to you is the person who comes and says, I have had that experience. Or I am in that situation now. I know what you're going through. The same words may come very, very glibly from others of us. But if we haven't been in the situation or are not in the situation, we can't really have the commonality that establishes the empathy with the other person. And that's what God decides to do. He will, in the person of his Son, come to earth. He will share our existence. He will come to know us in a different way. It wasn't that he didn't know us. What can you teach omniscience? It was that we had to be convinced that he knew us and that he cared about us. Søren Kierkegaard was a 19th century Danish philosopher, always ready with a homely illustration, told a story of a young king who wanted very much to be close to his subjects. He cared about them, but he didn't know how to communicate that care to them. He invited them to his castle, but his castle seemed so remote from their way of life, the point still was not established. One day, to the dismay of everyone in his court, he laid aside his royal garments, took on the clothing of a peasant, and for 1 year went out and lived among his people, worked among them, shared experiences with them. At first, they didn't recognize him. But eventually, when they came to know who he was and what he was doing, it revolutionized the whole kingdom. To know the king cares in this way meant everything to the subjects. And the same thing is what we're being told here, that God, for us humans and for our salvation, lays aside glory and comes and lives out a flesh and blood existence with us. He makes God tangible for us. Jesus the Messiah does. Now that's a difficult thing to get hold of. And perhaps an analogy is the most helpful thing we can do. A baby is born into your home. As James Dobson says, most of us who are parents say before a child is born, all we want is just a healthy, happy baby. Just a normal child. But after the child is born and it is healthy and normal, we begin to want several other things. We'd like him to be a little genius. We'd like her to have some outstanding beauty about her, and so on. Eventually, when the child becomes 2, 3, 4 years of age, we begin to notice some lack of perfection here and there. Here's a child who can't tell all the colors of the spectrum apart, can't distinguish them. And we get concerned. Healthy, normal, doesn't know his colors. And so we decide we'll lay everything else aside, and for a while we'll make clear to this child what colors are. Ever try that? Most parents have. Communicating what blueness is with verbal skills alone. Sitting there and telling a child what redness is just with words or greenness. It not only isn't easy, it's a futile effort. And eventually you decide, the only way I can do this is to take this abstraction, redness, and put it with something tangible. And so you take a red ball the child plays with all the time. And you explain, this ball is red. That's what redness is. This chair is green. That's what greenness is. This book is blue. That's what blueness is. In the most reverent way possible, we can say that what a red ball is to redness, and what a green chair is to greenness, and what a blue book is to blueness, the man Jesus of Nazareth is to God. He makes him tangible. He shows us what he is like. Another analogy, there are passing through this room right now at least 5 angles from local television stations. There are probably several other angles from stations a little bit more remote distance-wise from us. And yet, we don't see those lines, we don't hear those sounds because we aren't equipped to bring out the invisible and the inaudible and make them visible and audible for us. But if we should decide to do so, we might bring a television set into this room and it would transmute those signals and produce sounds and sights for us, so that we could pull out of the air by plugging it in and manipulating the controls, each of those signals. Again, in the most reverent way possible, what that television set would do for the waves that are crossing this room constantly is what the man Jesus of Nazareth did for God. He made him visible. He made him audible. He showed us what God is like. Now, the New Testament says that in lots of ways. In John 10, verse 30, Jesus said, "I and the Father are one." The Jews thought that was enough to deserve stoning, and they were prepared to stone him. In the 14th chapter, to his apostles on the night before his death, Philip said, "Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough for us." Jesus answered, "Don't you know me, Philip, even after I've been among you such a long time? Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, 'Show us the Father'? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words I say to you are not just my own. Rather, it's the Father living in me who is doing his work. Believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or at least believe on the evidence of the miracles themselves." Several times in Paul's letters, he establishes the same point. In 2 Corinthians 4, verses 5 and 6, he says, "For we do not preach ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for the will of God, for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ." In the simplest way we could put that, Jesus Christ puts a face on God. He shows us what God is like by himself, by his own appearance, by his own actions and words. In Colossians 1, begin with verse 15, Paul says, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross." And perhaps the warmest passage of all, a paragraph in Hebrews 4, where the writer of Hebrews is telling us what all of this means for daily life. "Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has gone through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way just as we are, yet was without sin. Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need." The writer is saying that God has shown himself to us in Jesus, that Jesus has now passed through the heavens and gone back to the right hand of God, and that he now will give us grace to help in our time of need when we approach the throne of God. That's what it all comes down to. A resource for daily life. One to teach us, to show us how to live and what the meaning of life really is. It means that wherever you are today and whatever your situation is, God can say from the inside, "I know what it's like." The Lord himself has gone through what we are going through, and he can truthfully say, "I understand. I've been there. I've walked that road." If you're a child, it's hard to think of God knowing what a child feels like, or of anyone knowing what a child feels like when one is a child. Remember the incident when Jesus went to Jerusalem when he was 12 years old? We're all familiar with his parents leaving him behind, and he's in the temple disputing with the teachers. Finally, when they came back and found him, his mother said, "Why have you treated us this way? Your father and I have looked for you." And he said, "Didn't you know that I had to be in my father's house? I had to be about my father's business?" But here was a love so great that it would almost absorb him. And a child who's already feeling the call far and away from the household in Nazareth to be out following the will of God. Every child knows what that's like. What it's like to be so overwhelmed by a love that possesses and keeps, and so filled with an internal desire to become an individual and answer the call from beyond himself or herself to become an individual and live out that special existence. Are you an adolescent? Lots of struggles in adolescence, but none greater than the time when you have to face the question, "What am I going to do with life? Who am I going to be? What am I going to try to accomplish? How will I spend my days and my nights?" Ever think of those questions in terms of Jesus' temptation? He was older than our period of adolescence. And yet, here are the same kinds of questions as Satan comes and makes his presentation. And Jesus has to face the question, "Am I going about my mission in a material way? Shall I take the bread solution? Bread for myself, bread for everybody else? Shall I dazzle people? Shall I look for fame, reputation? Shall I try to rule and dominate? How should I go about being the Messiah? How shall I spend my days and my nights?" Everyone who goes through that struggle can know he's been there. He's faced that kind of decision. Are you an adult? What adult doesn't feel torn by pressures that seem beyond our ability to fulfill? Children, parents, a wife or a husband, a job, a community. So many people make demands. They expect things from us. How can I ever perform? How can I ever fulfill all this? One fellow put it, "They tell me I'm in the prime of life. I feel more like a piece of prime rib being pulled in every direction." We all know that feeling. Look at the Gospels and see some of those busiest days in the life of Jesus, when an incredible number of things will be accomplished in one 24-hour period. Or look at him when people are disappointed in him. He comes to Bethany to share in the sorrow over his friend Lazarus having died, only to be greeted by Martha with the words, "Lord, if you'd just gotten here earlier," as if there's nothing else to do, as if he should be there at the moment. Who hasn't been through that? But those of us who are going through it can know that he's been there. Are you in older years? Jesus didn't pass through old age, and yet I'm convinced that he knows what it's like from the inside. Among the worst experiences people fear in old age are such experiences as loneliness, just feeling that everybody has forsaken me. Friends are gone, family is gone, I'm alone. He knows that feeling. On the cross, friends and family did forsake him. He even felt for the moment that God himself had forsaken him. Or the decline of physical strength, just being unable to take care of our own needs any longer. He knows that experience from the inside. The cry of thirst from the cross indicates that what we experience gradually over a period of years, he experienced compressed into a few hours. But he knows from the inside what your life is like. That's what we're being told, is we're told that God is made tangible in Jesus Christ. That he has experienced what we experience, that he cares, that he understands, that he offers help. Shortly after World War II, a German playwright named Günther Rutenborn wrote a play called The Sign of Jonah. It depicted in war-torn Germany a struggle to decide who is responsible for the atrocities of these last 5 years. And the play presents at its opening all the typical alternatives: Hitler, the Jews, the common man and his apathy, the bureaucrats. At that juncture, a man gets up from the audience and strolls up to the stage and says, "All of your answers are superficial. You know, if you'll think about it, who's responsible for all of this. Who made this world? Who gave human beings this dreadful freedom? Who sustained life while these wrongs were carried out? God is responsible." At first, there was shock. Gradually, the audience comes around, at least in the play, and the decision is made, the man's right, and the judge renders his sentence. And he sentences God Almighty to come to this miserable world and live as we wretched human beings live. And three archangels, Gabriel, Michael, and Raphael, are charged to carry out the sentence, execute it. As Gabriel leaves the stage, he stops and muses with himself for a moment, and he says, "When God lives out this sentence, I'm going to see to it that he's born in a barn on the backside of nowhere. He'll be born a Jew. He'll be born in a peasant home. He'll live in an occupied country. He'll learn what life is really like." And then he goes off into the darkness. As Michael leaves the stage, he stops and muses and says, "When God lives out this sentence, I'll see to it that he knows insecurity. Doesn't have any place to sleep. I'll see to it that he knows what it's like never to be understood, even by your closest friends or loved ones." And he goes off into the night. And as Raphael leaves the stage, he stops and muses, "When God lives out this sentence, I'll see that he knows what it's like to suffer a terrible death. He'll be illegally tried, shamefully accused. We'll cast all sorts of suspicion around him and his character, and eventually give him the death of a common criminal." And then the stage lights go down, and it suddenly dawns on people in the audience, God has already served that sentence. He has already, of his own free will, come to this miserable world and lived out an existence such as we human beings know, making God tangible for us humans and for our salvation. The Word became flesh and lived for a while among us. And the goal of it is that you and I should allow the Word to become flesh in our lives. Do you need to do His will? Would you? While we sing.